Welcome to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete Sunshine 96.7 FM. Join us as we celebrate the sparks that ignite, the events that inspire, and the songwriters that create. With your host, Steve Robb.
Susan Cattaneo is one of Boston's most respected singer-songwriters. A powerful singer and sophisticated writer, she combines vivid storytelling with a modern songwriter's spin. Respectful of tradition, but not bound by it, she blends rock, folk, and blues with a healthy dose of country. She's recorded 3 albums and been a Kerrville New Folk finalist 3 times and a 3-time nominee for Best American Artist at the Boston Music Awards. Susan Cattaneo, welcome to Song Creating.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for having me. I'm psyched to be here.
It's our pleasure. Where are you residing these days?
I'm coming to you from the beautiful town of Medford, Massachusetts, otherwise known as Medford. If you're from actually Medford.
Yeah, I think you're one town away from Mark Morelli. He's in Melrose.
I am. And we've actually gotten together a few times to co-write. So yes, he's just a hop, skip, and a jump from me.
It's funny. It seems like everybody gets together with Mark Morelli to co-write.
Yeah, he's so good. Oh, one of my favorite people to co-write with. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll bet. Well, he's got a lot of fans. We had him on and he talked about, well, actually I had him on, but also Dinty Child.
Who is my other favorite co-writer.
Yeah. And they actually talked about, Dinty talked about a song that they wrote together up on the island. Up in Winnipesaukee. So
yeah,
it's a lot of fun. So anyway, but we're not talking about them. We're talking about you.
Okay.
So it's great to have you. So let's go back. We're going to talk about your song here coming up. But before we get to that, tell me a little bit about where you started your songwriting, where something clicked.
Well, so that's actually a really cool, I think, interesting, you know, story as far as like what my origin story is as a songwriter, because I definitely did not start out as a songwriter. I came from a really musical family. We would all sing around the dining room table. We were from New Jersey, but we were like the Von Trapps of New Jersey. It's a Sound of Music all the time. But my sister, who was 6 years older than I am, was the singer in the family. Like she was like Broadway going that direction. And I think for me, I never really thought that that was something that I was going to do. So I was the writer. And then I was the alto part. So I was always the funny sidekick, because in musical theater, the lead is always a soprano and the funny sidekick is always the alto. So that was me. And so when I graduated from college, I ended up getting a job making movie trailers. I wrote movie trailers. So I worked in advertising for about 8 years and I was in a band at night. And so I had this like night and day life experience where I was like in the studio making commercials and then at nighttime in the clubs singing songs. I wrote a few songs for that band, but never thought about songwriting. I don't know.
Well, I want to go back to the movie trailers. Now, movie trailers, isn't the soundtrack to movie trailers songs from the movie itself?
Yeah, no, I wasn't writing songs. I was writing the script.
Oh, the script.
Thank you. Okay. So I was a copywriter. Well, they were called a, you know, writer producer.
Okay.
So you know, for instance, we did the whole Broadway, the whole broadcast launch of Schindler's List, for example, the first time that it was aired on television, I did all the movie trailers for it.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I was a writer. I wrote scripts.
But you didn't coin that phrase in a world, did you?
No. No. Although, you know, I've definitely written ones like that.
I wonder if somebody trademarked that line, because it's
so funny.
Made a lot of money on it.
Yeah.
Okay. So playing in bands and
playing in bands
in New York City. Okay.
Yep. And we ended up moving up here because my husband went to business school up here. So we left my life, moved up here. I got a great job in an amazing agency. Like it was my dream job in television. And my brother-in-law was going to Berkeley. And I remember thinking, oh my God, what is Berkeley? Like a contemporary music school? I want to do that. And so I foolishly, but not foolishly, quit my job and went to Berkeley as a student again. Like, so I got another degree. But when I was there, I took my first songwriting class, and I can only describe it as a religious experience. Like, I literally was like, oh, I have found my destiny. Like, wow. I really was so, I loved songwriting. I loved talking about songwriting. I loved writing songs. And I think because by the time I had finished my television job, I was like the head of the on-air department. So I had a whole stable of writers that I was working with and editing with and, you know, kind of molding, whatever. And so when I got into the classroom at Berkeley, I would just critique people's songs.
Now, I'm guessing, are you in your 20s, 30s?
No, I'm then 30, like early 30s. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Late and bloomer.
Totally. Exactly. Right. So I came to the music. Well, it even gets more interesting. And okay. So luckily my mentor was not threatened by that. And when I graduated, he offered me a job teaching there.
Wow. But at Berkeley.
Yeah. But I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I'm going to Nashville, because Nashville was the place where all of the kind of lyric driven songs were coming out of Nashville at that point. Like, all the really great writers were there. And so I was like, no, I don't want to teach. I want to go to Nashville. So I went to Nashville, and the job didn't work out. My husband was working for Gibson. It didn't work out. We got pregnant suddenly, and we were like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? So we moved back to Boston. Called up my mentor, Pat Pattison, and I was like, Pat, remember that job you offered me 6 months ago? Well, hey, could I take it now? So I started teaching at Berkeley right after I graduated, and also continuing to be a Nashville writer. So even though I wasn't there physically, I would go down there for, you know, a week, a month, co-write with people. I had a song plugger who was like an agent for you, who was pitching my songs to other artists. And I was like I feel like I was like the Marlon Brando of Nashville, where I was like, almost, I could have been a contender a lot of times. Like, I had songs on hold with everybody from Martina McBride, Trisha Yearwood, Diamond Rio, George Strait, you know. And nobody ever cut my songs. I had some cuts with B level artists.
Yeah.
I remember, like, even I had a song on hold with the artist Daughtry. Remember Daughtry?
Oh, sure.
And he was like so into my song and was totally going to cut it. And then went into the studio, and his producer had written a song that was kind of in the same tempo, and they ended up cutting the one that his producer had written rather than mine. So I did that for a really long time, and, you know, got this very large catalog of songs.
And were you performing in Nashville at this time too?
Not yet, because we had little kids at home. So I was, you know, I was being a mom and mainly writing. And then our kids got older, and my husband was like, you know what? You've got all these songs. And I was known as kind of I wrote really, you know, empowering women songs. Like, I wrote like songs about what it's like to be a woman. And so mm-hmm. I was kind of known for that. And my husband's like, why don't you let's return to your performing and, you know, release these songs under your name. So I had a brief career as a pop country artist. And that was very funny, because that was kind of like, wearing someone else's clothes. You know, I really was trying to be something that I wasn't. And yeah. I remember, you know, I would sing with a Southern accent, and I would, they wouldn't let me wear my glasses, and I literally cannot see without my glasses, and I can't wear contacts. So my time in Nashville is just like a blur of flesh colored faces that I don't remember. I don't know who I met, because I couldn't see them. And
I've often wondered about the country songs, whether or not they're really country songs just because they're sung with a country accent.
Oh, yeah. And they have a pedal steel on it and a fiddle.
Yeah,
you know, it's
yeah.
like they're now, especially these days, because these days it's all pop music with like a country sheen on it. But
right.
So for me, I had this kind of like, I was headed down that road. I did radio tours, and I charted, not on the Billboard charts, but on the Music Row chart, as a country artist, and felt really like I was not being myself. And it's so funny because here I am, meanwhile, teaching at Berkeley, telling my students to write their truth.
Yeah.
And I was not writing my truth in any way. If the song needed a truck, well, dang it, I was going to put that truck in there. You know, like I was just like doing whatever it took. And I think it's so funny because I guess I needed to kind of chase that. I needed to chase that star to realize that that really wasn't what I wanted to do. So I had this kind of epiphany and I changed the style of writing to go from more pop country to Americana. And I wrote the album Haunted Heart, which was kind of the first album where I think I really wrote my truth. I really wrote, I opened up the closet and all of my skeletons were out wandering around in these songs. And the cool thing about that is that once you do that, you kind of can't close the door. Mm. You kind of can't go back. It's really life-changing and so self-affirming and so wonderful to put out some artistic product that feels so close to who you are.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, and then it was so funny because after chasing, wanting people to like me so much, and what could I do to make you like me? Once I was like, screw it, I'm just doing what I want to do. That was when I started to get on people's radars. Mm. that was the album that kind of like launched me, so to speak.
Isn't that interesting? And somewhat ironic in a way.
Yes. Yes.
So when they were grooming you in Nashville, did they have the dancers working? I'm thinking of A Star Is Born and what they did with poor Lady Gaga's character. How they just kept.
Well, no, because I was in the same kind of vein as you know, Chris Stapleton, like that, you know. So I was
oh, okay.
I was a little more rougher or harder. I wasn't the ingenue because I wasn't age-wise an ingenue.
Yeah.
So you know, they kind of didn't know what to do with me, which was probably, you know, thank goodness. I think sometimes about that because I remember I had just finished this album and my husband, who's my manager, was like, we had this really big, what we call in Nashville, like come to Jesus, which was like, you know, what do you really want to do with your life? And do you like these songs that you're singing? And I'm like, well, they're really fun to sing. And Dina was like, yeah, but if we go for this and any of these songs get traction of any shape or form, you're going to have to sing these songs for the rest of your career.
Yeah.
So if you don't relate to these songs and they really aren't you, you have to kind of reevaluate what you want to do with your career. And so I remember I was right in the middle of like negotiating this deal with this big person in Nashville. And he was like, I can't believe you're giving up like the potential to reach a huge audience and make money to go to a smaller genre, smaller market and probably make no money. Are you sure you want to do that? And I was like, yes, because I can live with myself. You know,
yeah.
I, you know, so that then I became an Americana songwriter and I haven't looked back since. And I've put out three albums under that kind of real feeling, whatever art. And that is Haunted Heart. And then the next one was The Hammer in the Heart, which was a double album that had like a rock acoustic side. And then this latest one, which is called All Is Quiet.
Okay. So. I wanted to ask you about, you know, you brought up the acoustic and the rock side. And as I know, I love playing all different kinds of music and writing all different kinds of music. I've got a whole, I call it island vibe. You know, I just love this beach kind of sound, but then at the same time I'm writing, you know, songs about whiskey and, you know, gravel roads. And how do you I don't know if you suffer from the same lack of focus that I do, but do you find that your voice gives your songs a continuous sound, but do you find that you're that there's enough variety in the songs still that you don't feel pigeonholed?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. Because I think that, you know, there are lots of other ingredients that you can put into a song to kind of create variety. So for me, you know, it's like my voice is going to be the constant, right? But then what instrumentation am I surrounding the song with? You know, that can really have an influence on the dynamics, on the feel of it. So, I mean, for me, I don't necessarily, I don't think that I write out of the very broad Americana genre. So I think that, and that's a combination of like folk, blues, rock, and with a little bit of country. So I think like that's kind of where I sit very comfortably. And I write in that style. Now, that's not to say that I haven't written in other genres and other styles, but I usually have done that kind of thing when I'm co-writing with another artist. So I co-write with a lot of people, and sometimes I'm co-writing with a specific person who has a specific sound and a specific genre. And so then that's kind of really fun because I get to explore, oh, I'm writing pop songs, you know, or I've done like indie stuff where it's like, oh, I can really embrace like this totally weird, I don't know, weird chord structure or weird melody. And, you know, I wouldn't probably sing it myself, but it doesn't mean that I don't have that side of my personality. And I love to explore that. So, yeah.
So let's go back, way back. It sounds like music came second to you after your writing skills. And so were you a poet as a girl, or?
Yeah, I wrote poems, and I wrote short stories, and I wrote plays, and I also remember, like, it was so funny because I also sang a lot. I remember just singing all the time. I remember singing all the time to the point where I think, you know, I remember like a teacher being like, Susan has to stop singing. She's like singing in math class. You know, I just sang all the time, but I never connected that to the words. I don't know why it never occurred to me. It's so funny. I think it's because, you know, I was raised on like musical theater and Great American Songbook. So I wasn't, those songs were like firmly established in the culture of America. So it wasn't, the songwriter wasn't really an important part of that. It was, or at least my experience. You know, I knew the songwriters, but I more knew the artists, the performing artists. So,
right. Which were different until the Beatles came along.
Exactly.
Started actually writing. Amazing. They actually started writing their own music. Yeah. So the New Jersey sound didn't have a whole lot of effect on you?
No, unfortunately. Well, it did later, but no. I mean, you know, Dino's like, you were there when Springsteen was doing his thing. And I'm like, yeah, but I was listening to, you know, Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan. And, you know, I'm trying to think of who else, you know, that was kind of what I was raised with.
When you had the band in New York, what was the type of music?
So that was like, what did we call? We called ourselves folk funk.
Mm. Cool.
Oh my God. Yeah. It was called the Blackfish Band. And we played it like a ton. We played it, you know, Kenny's Castaways and the Bitter End. Like we were good. And our bass player was, an investment banker. And so he had this huge group of people that would come and follow him. So we had a very, very big following, and bars loved us because
big
we
spender.
Brought in a ton of people who would drink a lot and have a good time. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Okay. So let's move on to present day. Now you've got, you're a mom, you're still performing.
Yes.
Are you still going to Nashville?
No, I haven't gone to Nashville in a bunch of years. It's so funny because Nashville for me feels a little bit like it's the one that got away. It's like the lover that I can't give up. And every time I think like, I'm done with Nashville, then I'm like, oh, I could have been, you know, I could have done that. But I think that for me, being a performing artist has been more rewarding than being a songwriter for others in Nashville, which I think, you know, there's a lot of like songwriter for others in there. And I, for me, like I'm loving the performing right now. And especially now post pandemic, I'm so grateful for any opportunity to play out and to perform and to co-write and to collaborate. And because for a while, you know, I didn't know that I needed to take that for granted until it was over for a little bit.
I think you were at Passim recently. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, you know, of course, a great club. I went to took my wife to a Nashville songwriter show where four of the songwriters. So this is just like they do at the Listening Room in Nashville.
Yeah.
And they played their songs that they wrote, and I was thinking about whether you had done that as well, because so often the songwriters are really as good as the performers that end up recording those songs. And sing it with it in a different way. Was that ever anything that that you participated in Nashville?
Oh yeah, totally. Yes.
At the Listening Room or
No, I did because I was really like when I would go to Nashville, I was like I am here to write, so I wasn't necessarily there to perform.
Yeah.
But you know, we played. I did one at the Bluebird, and I played at Third and Lindsley, and the Mercy Lounge, like you know, and. It's usually in the round. And then there was one called, oh shoot, I can't remember what it was called, right near my hotel that I would always stay in.
So did you ever watch the show Nashville?
No, because I was like, I remember someone telling me, oh yeah, there's like a young ingenue and then there's this older songwriter that, and I'm like, no, I don't want to hear about an older songwriter. Yeah, I was in denial then, but yeah.
Yeah, I wonder how true to form that show actually was. I got a kick out of it. It did put Bluebird on the map, but everybody knows about the Bluebird now.
Right.
Now you've been writing, you've got this third album, and the song is the title track off your third album?
Yes.
It is. Okay. Yes. And it started, it took a little, it metamorphosized. Is that the proper
that
word?
That is a good verb for it.
It
yes.
veered, it started one way and veered the other. And, I should just shut up and let you talk about it because, I want to hear about how the progression of or the track that it was on,
yeah,
and then how you ended up you know working it to a different different direction.
Well, so The Hammer in the Heart was a double album, right? And I produced it myself. It had 18 tracks on it. I wanted the theme of that album to be about my love of collaboration with people. So I had 41 different musicians on that album. It was insane. And I recorded it in different studios with different engineers. And I had different co-writers and different people singing background vocals for me and different players every single time. And it was this, it was like a circus and it was awesome. It was a fabulous, big, wonderful, exciting circus. But it was very, you know, it took me a year to record it. And at the end of that year, I was like so close to being done. I literally had like one vocal to sing and I fell headfirst down a flight of stairs and really, really, really hurt myself. Shattered my wrist, broke my hand, broke both fingers, broke my feet, and was concussed. Like I was just a mess for like 6 months while I'm promoting the release of this album and touring in a side project with a group called the Boxcar Lilies. And it was just a really, really challenging time. So I had decided already that whatever I was going to do next, if I was going to do another album, it was going to be not that. It was going to be something where I was going to pare it down and just kind of get back to the purity of vocal guitar or vocal piano. So I'd already decided that. And unlike all the rest of my albums, which I could never decide what to call an album until I'd recorded the whole thing, and then I'd be like, what do I call it? This one, I was like, this is going to be called All Is Quiet. I knew that already. So then our kids, you know, had gotten to college age and left for the first time in 2019. And I was like, oh my gosh, okay, so All Is Quiet is going to be about the empty nest. It's going to be about what it's like to rediscover your partner that you're married to and rediscover what it's like to take time for yourself after being in service to people, blah, blah, blah. Then 2020 came around and suddenly, you know, the kids moved home with us. So things were not so quiet. And I, to be completely honest, I was really, really sad for those first few months, March, April, May. I just remember thinking my whole life is done. Like, what, you know, remember, because in the beginning, we didn't know if anybody was going to be able to sing again outside in public. And I'd worked so hard to build up this momentum in my career and to feel like it had all just gone. And I know that some people, and I was still, you know, I was teaching at Berkeley, teaching remotely still. And I know that a lot of people that I was in contact with, both students at Berkeley and also, you know, songwriter friends outside of Berkeley, were really inspired by this time in their lives. They were like, oh, I don't have to tour. I can stay home. I'm going to be so creative. I'm going to create tracks. I'm going to do all this thing. I did not do that. I sat on the couch and watched a lot of Netflix and was sad. And I thought like, well, maybe that's it. Maybe, you know, after, I don't know, writing 250 songs, maybe I'm done. Maybe I don't have anything more to say. And for the first time in my life, I've never had that experience. I've never been able to kind of, I've never not been able to take what I'm feeling and translate it into something artistic. That's how I process, right? Write a short story, write a poem, create something with art, or write a song. And for the first time, I just did nothing. I did nothing. I ate Oreos for 3 months. But then I realized after 3 months that not being creative, depriving myself of that road to write to express myself, was making me sadder. And so I was sort of in like a songwriting group online where they're like, finish a song. And I'm like, ugh, I don't know. And somebody at one point said to me that they were doing this exercise where you find a picture of your younger self. And instead of doing what people always do, which is, what would I tell my younger self? You know, I would tell her, don't drink that tequila when you're 16, or don't fall in love with whatever. Instead of doing that, look at the picture of your younger self and tell, what would your younger self say to you as an older person? And I was like, oh, my younger self, who in this picture that I found looks so like brave and unafraid and courageous about the world. I was like, I need to follow that. I need to follow that feeling. So I wrote a song called Follow, which is about following your intuition. And that ended up being the last song on the album. And then I had to write All Is Quiet. And initially, you know, before the COVID, it was like this rocking, like, you know, I was like, oh, it's going to be loud because it's quiet. And then I was like, no, All Is Quiet is about what it feels like to be creatively muted. And so I wrote that song, and it is the first song on the album intentionally, because I feel like the album started from a place where I thought it was the end of writing for me, but it ends with so it starts with an end and it ends with a beginning, in the sense that it ends with, no, you have to follow your intuition.
Did you rewrite your lyrics, or were you,
I rewrote,
you had to
the
interpret
whole
them
thing.
Differently? The whole thing.
I changed like, The whole feel of it was different. It was like this rockin' song. And I had the hook, and I repeated the hook 3 times. So that I guess that part stayed. Mm-hmm. But I changed the whole, like, it's so interesting because it had this ascending melody. It had a melody that went up. It had a chord structure that kind of also kind of matched that and had like energy, and also it had an upward movement to it. And I was like, no, it needs to have a downward movement to it. So the whole thing is built on chords descending, 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 descending. Yeah. And then the lyric is pretty static melodically in the verses. And then it really soars kind of in the chorus.
Could you make a song out of your first version, a separate song?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
I haven't thought about doing that, but yeah, I totally could do that. Yeah.
It seems like you got almost there.
And, yeah.
The kids. Okay, your college age children, whatever you want to call them.
Semi-adults. Yes.
Are they still home, or have they been able to get back?
No, they've fled the nest as quickly as possible. No, my son is now going to be 23. Oh my God. And he is a stand-up comedian in New York.
Oh my gosh.
In Brooklyn. And my daughter was at Syracuse University in New York State, and then they're both, my kids are really interesting because they're both like this combination of art and something else. So my son was a physics and drumming major, and now he's a stand-up comedian. And my daughter was a fashion sociology major, and now she's sociology, and she transferred to a college in California, and she loves it, and it's a much better fit for her than the other school was. So that was actually a good thing that happened as a result of the pandemic, was that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm still caught up on the drumming and physics major becoming
right, I know.
A comedian.
I know. You got to laugh, I guess.
He's writing his own jokes, obviously. So so there, you've got that. So some of your writing prowess has worked its way down one more generation.
They have inherited. Well, and in many ways, I'm like, oh, what have I done to them? Because they've spent their entire lives like listening to my songwriting, listening to my rough recordings, listening to my final recordings, listening to like the poor things. I've just driven around in the car with all of that, all the tracks going on when I was taking them to school and bringing them home. And so as a result, I don't know if this is a good or a bad thing, but they're both really good writers and they're both really good editors.
Mm.
Like my daughter is like, she is just on it. You know, I'll play a song for her and she'll be like, oh, and she's got the terminology. She'll be like, you know, when the prosody in your bridge just isn't really working in that first line. I think the second line probably needs to be shorter. And, you know, your melody, you know, I really like the minor chord. Like she's
wow.
All over it. So
I mean, that's really helpful to have somebody like that who actually says it like it is.
Yeah, she's really good.
Yeah. So so I've got your lyric sheet on my computer screen here. And you mentioned about editing and rewriting. There aren't a lot of words in this song.
No.
I've seen some lyric sheets that are, you know, just full. And less is more in a way.
Yes.
Absolutely, right? Did you do a lot of rewriting and editing throughout? I mean, and how do you write? Do you write on paper or are you on a computer where you can delete and then fill in, or you know, paper is always fun to look at afterwards. You got all the scratching out and everything too.
I wish that I wrote on. I used to write on paper, but unfortunately, I think that I missed my calling and I should have been a doctor in another life because my handwriting is so illegible. And since my accident of falling down the stairs, my handwriting is now worse than it was before. So I always, when the computer finally came out, I remember being so incredibly relieved because I was like, finally, I can have a place to organize my thoughts. And songwriting is really interesting for me because I usually start with a title. I usually have like a title idea and I write from that. But all of the pieces are there and I just have to kind of move them around. So it's a little bit like a jigsaw puzzle where I'll be like, oh, you know, I have like a rhyme and I'm like, oh, I definitely want this rhyme to happen. Where does it happen? Does it happen over here? No, let me move it over here. Does it happen over here? No, let me try it over here. And, you know, or I'll come up with a line and I think, oh, this is the chorus. And I'm like, oh no, it isn't the chorus. This is actually a verse. And I'm like, okay, so what's the chorus? But I have all of the material either in my head or actually in a document. And I just kind of move stuff around until it feels right. All Is Quiet went through, I would have to say, yeah, definitely. I'm a writer and an editor. So I definitely rewrite a lot. For me, the fact that there are very few lyrics was really, really important. Because I mentioned a term, prosody. Prosody is when the structure of the lyric, the melody, the chords reflect what you're trying to say emotionally in the lyric. And I wanted the song to be quiet, and I wanted there to be a lot of space to it because I felt that that conveyed how it felt for me. That
experience. Are we getting a free? Are we getting a free Berklee songwriting class here?
Always.
What is that word? Prosody. How do you spell that?
Prosody. It's P-R-O-S-O-D-Y.
I have not heard that.
It's the best term ever.
Wow.
Because you can, if you think about like songs, I don't know, like I have like a ton of examples of, but there's like, you know, kind of obvious ones like, you know, Garth Brooks's, I got friends in low places, low, right? The word low the lowest part in the song. It's on the word low. You can find it everywhere. I mean, so there's a you know, the Paul Simon song, there's a train in the distance. There's like a whoo, like, you know, a vocal in there that sounds like a train. And there's a, you know, you can find it in more modern music. There's a song called The Middle by Maren Morris. And the melody goes, it's called The Middle, right? And the melody goes, why don't you just meet me in the middle? Da-da, I'm losing my mind just a little. Right, so we get like this, da. It keeps going back to that middle melody. So there are really subtle ways that you can melodically and lyrically, like structurally, you know, shorten the line, lengthen the line, change the rhyme to actually create a sense of what the lyric is trying to say. So, you know,
it's kind of a means of reinforcement.
Yes. And it's so subtle that it's something that I don't even think the listener realizes that they're being taken on this specific journey.
They're being manipulated.
They are. But you know, if you think about, if you hear a song and I don't know, like the verse is about being insecure, but the chorus is about like, yay, everything's okay. And if in my verse, I had it in a minor key and I have kind of lines that aren't the same length, and I use, instead of perfect rhyme, I use family rhyme or slant rhyme, your listener is going to hear that and pick up that, oh, something's not quite right, while I'm telling you that something is not quite right. And then when you get to the chorus where you want it to kind of have this release and have it, I think of it as like light and shadow. You know, if you're in shadow in the verse and you want to come to light in the chorus, using perfect rhyme, using equal line lengths, using a major key, there are all of these things that you can do that will have the feel of what you're trying to say.
Now, this is a question that I find very trite, but I feel it needs to be asked. Are you, well, I don't think I need to ask it. You're a lyric first.
I am.
You are.
Well, I'm a lyric singer is how I would describe it.
Okay.
So for me, I, you know, if you listen to my songs, I'm very much, I'll play with chords, but I'm not a chord smith. Mm-hmm. It's just really not where my ear goes. So I usually come up with a title. I then kind of immediately sing the title because I'm like, oh, how does it sound? And then that leads me to what the tempo of the song is or what the feel of the song is. And so I'm usually singing and writing at the same time. And then I pick up the instrument, guitar or piano. So that's usually like the third thing that I do. And then I switch sometimes between guitar and piano while I'm writing the song.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure which instrument is going to speak what I want to say the best.
You've said this a few times. You really write the title first. You do that on most of your songs.
Or a line, like a line from a verse. Words first. Yeah.
I kind of find that a first line is you know, like even writing a novel, you got to write that first line. It starts everything. But I think only a few times have I started with a title because the title was so catchy. You know, I heard it somewhere else. I didn't come up with it. What's another song on this album that you started with the title? Can you think of one offhand?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All of them.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, so there is a song that's called I'll do this one. There's a song that's called Hold On to Hope. And so in November of 2021, is that right? Yeah, I guess that was. Or November of 2020, 2021. No, 2020, sorry. My dad had a bad accident, and we were all on the phone with him because he had to make some really important kind of medical decisions. And so it was the whole family on a Zoom. And, you know, my dad was really upset because his options didn't look good. He survived and it was okay, but it was a really rough time. And I remember my dad saying something like, I just don't know. I don't know what I can hope for. And my brother-in-law, who's a poet, by the way, said, well, you know, you've just got to hold on to your hope. And I remember being like, oh, yeah. Oh my God, what is that? What is that? So I had that title. But what had happened years ago is I had written this country song that, I don't know if you know, there's a country song like, if you're going through hell, keep on going. That sure. was, it's like a country, you know. And I think
that's an old Winston Churchill line.
Oh, yeah.
You may have heard it from Ben Franklin. Maybe. Who knows? But
Luke Bryan stole it. No, just kidding. I don't know who sings that song. But yeah, so I'm like, and I remember thinking, like, I wanted to write my version of that song. So I had this music and this lyric that was like, you know, when you feel at the end of your rope, tie a knot and don't let go. That was my version of if you're going through hell, keep on going. And it was like a boom, chucka, boom, chucka, ding, ding, ding kind of thing. And I had this and I was walking the dog and I remember thinking, hold on to hope. Huh? Hold on to hope. Oh my gosh. It rhymes with rope. What is that lyric? What was that lyric that I wrote? Mm-hmm. And I pulled up this, like, when you feel at the end of your rope, tie a knot and don't let go, hold on to hope. And suddenly I was like, oh, that's the song. Like, and I really, and so thinking of prosody, because that song had, like, I don't know why for me, the images that came to mind when I was thinking about that were like, you know, holding onto a rope swing and also like walking on a tightrope, that for some reason that was walking on a tightrope in the wind, I guess, is, you know, that really like,
yeah, sure,
swaying
right.
thing.
That's right.
And so I naturally went to a waltz feel because I wanted to convey a sense of swing, a sense of things being like in flux and mm-hmm. things not being stable. And so for me, that song melodically and musically kind of translates what I think of as holding on to hope when things are really like uncertain. And I'll do that, like, even in, you know, in that song in particular, like the verb choices that I'll use. I remember like the first line of that song goes, you know, when your faith, it was like when your faith starts to whatever, something, and, you know, and you feel like you're lost. Like, so when your faith starts, and what is your faith going to do? And I remember also walking the dog, I'm thinking, what is your faith going to do? Well, when your faith starts to fray, right? It's a specific verb because it means to, it's like a rope can fray. I could have said when your faith goes away or when your faith starts to fade or when your faith starts to, I don't know, cascade. I don't know what it is. But for me, like choosing fray, that was intentional. Like I do a lot of, I like the fact that, well, now sometimes I even do it without thinking, but I think when I look back at the song, I'll be like, oh yeah, I purposely chose that verb. That seemed like the right thing. And going back to All Is Quiet specifically, the idea of sitting vigil. So the song starts with sitting vigil in this house until the morning comes. So I have vigil and until, there are internal rhyme going on in there. But I chose sitting vigil because for me, not having the creative inspiration felt like a death. So I'm purposely sitting vigil. I'm not like sitting around or I'm not like looking out the window. Do you know what I mean? Like I'm sitting vigil for for my creativity. And so for me, I love that. I love the fact that the language can support what I'm trying to say emotionally. I do that a lot in my songs.
I'm enjoying this lesson. Do you give lessons on Zoom? What do you?
I do indeed. Yes. Well, so that was the other thing. So the pandemic, you know, I've taught at Berkeley for 20 years, and the last year and a half I've been teaching remotely. And, you know, there's nothing like a good pandemic to really make you realize what you want to do in your life. And yeah. having had 20 years where one foot was in academia and one foot was in the art world, creating music and writing with people, I quit Berklee.
Oh, you did?
I did. And I still teach online. So I'm still associated with Berklee, but I'm not going in on campus anymore. And, you know, that was very scary, but also incredibly liberating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are like, do you miss it? I'm like, no, I don't miss it. The only thing I miss is that those students that I had in the year and a half, you know, it was rough for everybody. And like every week it'd be like, people would be like, what are you going to write about this week? And students raise their hand, be like, depression. I'd be like, anxiety, worry, you know, like whatever, loneliness, you know, everybody was writing songs about that. And my only regret is that I didn't get a chance to meet any of those students in real life. Mm. And that is my one like sadness. Cause I loved that we shared that experience. We went through something together that was really powerful and difficult and awesome.
It is surprising how much you can get to know somebody through a computer screen.
Yeah. Well, especially, I think if I were teaching harmony or if I were teaching, I don't know, like traditional counterpoint one or two or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, obviously I would just know the students because there'd be the material, they have to learn the material. But, you know, I'm teaching songwriting. So there's already kind of a window into somebody's soul that we're kind of opening up and translating into music. And so, yeah, it can be very, very intimate and very personal and very, very illuminating. And so, yeah, so I don't teach at Berklee. But I teach like remotely, and I'm kind of creating like a workshop thing that I'm going to launch hopefully in the fall.
Great. So you got a lot of things ahead of you.
Yeah.
And I imagine you probably got another album in the works, right?
Well, so yes, I do. I do. It's hard because I think, you know, a part of me is like, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? But once again, I have to kind of just know that I really like to make stuff. I really like to write songs, and that's just going to be what it's going to be.
Creators need to create. You just have to do it.
Well, and I also think that, like, as you know this, Steve, you know, as a creative person, it can be very easy to compare yourselves to other people and to kind of look, especially with, I don't know, social media. Social media is like crack for insecure artists. You know, it's like, because you look and you're like, why did they have it? Why didn't I have it? And I think that whenever that happens for me, I just have to kind of take a step back and just literally put my head down and keep doing the work. Like I feel like there is pleasure in the work. There is a sense of accomplishment and reward in putting something out into the world, whatever it is. And I think that whenever I'm feeling insecure, I have to kind of like take a step back and think that that's what matters. Like, you know, I'm just putting stuff out into the world, you know, and it resonates with people, and it might resonate with 10 people or it might resonate with 10,000, but that really isn't the point. The point is to express yourself creatively and see what happens when you go there.
Well, I just, you know, the whole thing about creating something from 12 notes, and that just didn't exist.
Yeah.
It just didn't exist. You know, granted, somebody could say, oh, a lot of this copies of something else, but let's not go there. It didn't exist. And you know, how much three chords can just keep being repeated into something new. It's amazing. I just love the idea that there's always room for something else.
Yes.
And it just keeps coming.
Well, and there's always room for someone else too. I think that that's like really, you're totally right. Because, you know, people are like, oh, I can't write another song about love. I'm like, why not? Because your perspective on love is going to be different than someone else's. What you bring to the picture, what you bring to the creative process is your own. It's unique. It's special.
Yeah. It sounds like you write a lot from your own experience.
Now I do. I didn't before.
when you had to write for somebody else.
Yes. Yeah. But now, yes, now I really don't, I don't write something unless I'm feeling it. So, yeah. And that's really amazing. Like I'm still, you know, I was saying to someone the other day that I still have this, I'm so grateful. I'm just so grateful. And I, you know, I'll write a song and, well, in the old days I had a full band, now not so much, but you know, I remember like bringing a new song in and just like inside being like, I can't believe I wrote this song. People are playing this song. Oh my gosh. They're listening to me. Oh my gosh. You know, I've written this part and people are playing it. It's just so amazing. And then, you know, to go out, especially these days when people have so many options, you know, Netflix, Hulu, especially now there's so many options.
Oreo cookies.
Yeah. Oreo cookies. The fact that people leave their house at all to see live music is just a gift. Yeah. It's a gift. An amazing
thing. You've written sad songs. And you know, sad is such a generalization term. But do you find you've got to dig deep? I mean, you're happily married. You got two healthy kids. I'm in the same boat, thankfully, right? And I feel like I've got to kind of channel someone else and, you know, become you know, that, what's the word, you know, find that empathy in me for, you know, other friends who are going through a divorce or something like that. I mean, I know I can look deep and find, you know, obviously there are always things that we can be sad about and heartbroken about, but sometimes you really need to kind of experience it. But songwriters are very empathetic and really can speak for other people who may not have the words, you know, to speak, to say what they're trying to say. And I wonder if that's something that you're feeling challenged with or what do you think?
No, I mean, I think like if anything, I'm probably on the other side. Like I'm probably feeling too much all the time. Like I'm probably somebody who, you know, and in fact, I find that, I think that's why for me, probably it makes me a good songwriter and a good teacher is the fact that I'm able to really empathize with people and I'm really able to connect with them. But I think that, oh, especially these days, man, you know, like trying to find the silver lining. I'm like, where is it? Oh God, I lost it again. You know, I think we're living in a particularly challenging time. At least I feel the weight of the world these days. And so for me, conjuring up sadness is a lot easier than conjuring up hopefulness, even though it's there, you know, and I think, especially because like, you know, when you think about songs, I love hearing songs that are not sad, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when I do a set, if I'm performing live, I know that people get away with having like an entire set of sad songs. I have never been able to do that. I'll do like three and I'll be like, oh my God, this is so sad. We got to do something not sad. Yeah. So, you know, I think that I don't know how people get away with it. For me, I can't, I have to have a little more variety. So yeah. And I think the next album is going to be a full band album and it's going to be loud and it's going to be, so after this one, oh, I didn't even talk about like, so this one, All Is Quiet, only has three people on it. It's Kevin Berry, Duke Levine, and me. And that's it. So no other additional instrumentation. So two guitars, one vocal. And I, you know, sang a lot of harmonies. So I feel like my voice was also an additional kind of instrument. But that was really different. To only have that palette of sound to work with meant that my vocal, you know, it was really scary. I couldn't hide behind anybody. You know, my vocal was there. I had to kind of accept that that's how I sound. I had to accept, you know, it's easier to lose yourself in a band.
Yeah. It sounds like this would be a very affordable tour.
Yes. Well, they're not available to tour. So Kevin Berry is on tour with Jackson Browne and Duke Levine is Bonnie Raitt's lead guitarist right now. And they're both, what I think I love most about them is the fact that they know how to support a singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
They know when to play. They know when not to play. They know how to add really like the perfect kind of shading or texture to someone's song. It's just a magical thing. And working with them remotely was so weird. I never saw them. We just sent the tracks around.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm very pleased with the results of All Is Quiet. But so the new album's going to be a full band and loud and happier, hopefully.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Hopefully. Or at least angry. It might be angry. Angry and loud.
All right. Well, we've got that to look forward to. All right. Well, Susan Catania, this has been a lot of fun. I feel like through Zoom, I've gotten to know you. So yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun. I love talking about songwriting. So thank you so much.
Well, we love hearing about it. And thank you for the free Berklee course.
Yeah, anytime.
Very, very enjoyable.
Nice.
All right. We're going to listen to Susan, Duke, and Kevin and their recording of All Is Quiet, the title track of Susan Catania's new album, which you can find at,
anywhere. SusanMusic.com.
SusanMusic.com. Wow, you got that?
I'm like Cher. I'm like Madonna. All you need is one name, baby, and you got me.
SusanMusic.com. All right, terrific. Well, this is a great song. All right. Thanks a lot, Susan.
Thanks.
Sitting vigil in this house until the morning comes. Wondering if I'll be myself still when all is done, and I'm right back to square one. Idle hands make idle worries. Have I lost all sound and story? All is quiet. All is quiet. All is quiet. So begins an end.
And so begins.
Thanks for listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete. If you like what you hear, you can find Song Creating on your favorite podcast app or at songcreating.com. To check out my own music, go to steverobb.com. And until next time, keep a song in your head and music in your heart. Thanks for listening.